Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the recent visit to Iran by Turkey's President Erdogan after an earlier visit to Saudi Arabia, and look into a possible shift in regional alliances as Saudi Arabian military involvement in Yemen deepens and warnings from Iran are ignored. Henri Baki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University and a former member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss whether the rumored talks between the Saudis and Turkey in Qatar aimed at removing Syria's Assad indicate a new boldness from the Saudis or paranoia over a possible U.S. rapprochement with Iran. Then, as the just-announced presidential candidate Hillary Clinton heads to Iowa in a van on a road trip across Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, we will speak with someone who has known her since she first met her husband Bill, Ambassador Derek Shearer, a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, joins us to discuss whether in a country whose politics are dominated by a plutocracy, there is still an American meritocracy, and whether his old friend Hillary could become the first female president of the United States. Then finally, we'll look into the remarks made by Pope Francis that the Armenian genocide was the first genocide of the 20th century and that Turkey's concealing or denying evil is like allowing a wound to keep bleeding. Ronald Suni, a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago and the author of a new book just out, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide, joins us. And joining us now is Henri Baki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. He has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Baki.
Thank you.
And in the introduction, I was asking rhetorically whether or not these rumored talks between the Saudis and Turkey in Qatar aimed at removing Syria's Assad indicate a new boldness from the Saudis or paranoia over a possible U.S. rapprochement with Iran. I forgot to mention that the rumors may not be true.
No, they may not be true. I think the rumors suggested that Turkish ground troops with Saudi air support would go into Syria. I mean, that was one set of rumors. And I think it's very, very unlikely that the Turks would engage in such bold action and also that the Saudis would do the same. And because, first of all, Syria is in a state of civil war. It's true the Assad regime is not very strong, certainly not strong enough to withstand a concerted action by Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But the devil is always in the details, in that such an operation would have no support at home in Turkey, and any casualties will reverberate very, very badly on the Turkish government. And also, this is also Turkish government that is waiting or is getting involved, is getting engaged now in a major political campaign. There are elections on June 7th in Turkey, so nothing will happen before the elections. Now, we can always be surprised, but I suspect that the aftermath of the elections will be sufficiently uncertain in terms of what President Erdogan wants to achieve for the Turks to engage in military action. And I think that this kind of story, you never know, may be planted as a way of trying to warn Washington, as you said, that you know, people in the region, especially the Saudis, are rather upset with President Obama's moves towards Iran, with the Iran nuclear deal. And this is a way of saying we can upset the apple cart. And it's true. Such military action would create havoc in the region because the Iranians are heavily involved in Syria. Without Iranian support and Hezbollah support, Assad would have fallen by now. So if you are taking on Assad, it means you're also taking on the Iranians. So I think this is more bluster than something to be taken seriously.
And, of course, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, was in Iran last week. What do you think those discussions were about?
Well, this is the amazing thing about the Turkish-Iranian relationship. Even though the Turks and the Iranians are on opposite sides, are at loggerheads when it comes to Assad. Yet, they have a very cordial relationship. They have learned to agree to disagree in a kind of very mature and very friendly way. Why? Because both countries realize they need the other one. Turkey buys a lot of its energy from both in terms of oil and gas from Iran, and Iran doesn't have many export opportunities, so relies on Turkey as a market. As a result, you don't want to upset this apple cart and create problems with your most important commercial outlet for your oil and gas. So the Turks and the Iranians have done a very good job of agreeing to disagree. And despite the fact, and I would like you to compare President Erdogan's rhetoric on Iran or Russia, for that matter, with his rhetoric on the United States. When it comes to Iran and Russia, he has not very critical things to say, especially those countries' support for Bashar al-Assad. But when it comes to the United States, he's virulent in his criticism of the United States. Yet the United States and Turkey agree on the need for Bashar al-Assad to go. So you have this very bizarre relationship out there between the Iranians and the Turks. So that's also another reason, by the way, and you're absolutely right in pointing this out, that it's unlikely that the Turks would engage in military action against Assad Syria. Although one can make the argument that in some ways, whether or not Assad stays or goes has to be determined not by United States, not by Europe, not by the Russians, but the countries in the region, because they are the ones who are suffering. They are the ones who have to live with the refugee crisis. They have to live with all the aftermath of the war next door. So in a way, the Turks and the Saudis have, even though the Saudis don't have a border, of course, with Syria, live in the region and are affected by it. And they should have, a long time ago, taken the initiative to figure out an alternative solution to the Assad problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he has co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. So, but the one thing that the U.S. and Erdogan have in common is that they both predicted the premature demise of Assad and his regime. And it does seem that Erdogan had a lot invested in getting rid of Assad. He was furious at him. And is there any change underway with this new king in Saudi Arabia, given that the previous king, his predecessor, was his defense minister was so dead against anything to do with the Muslim Brotherhood, any form of political Islam was an anathema to them because it challenges their kind of medieval monarchical rule. Is there any indication that the new Saudi king and his somewhat reckless young son, who has not been educated abroad and sounds like he's really going to get himself into a real pickle in Yemen, allegedly have a different approach, and they're much more willing to, not so much to coexist, shall we say, with the Muslim Brotherhood?
Look, it is possible that there is some new thinking going on in Saudi Arabia. I'm not equipped to ascertain that one way or the other, I have to say. Look, some new thinking is really necessary in the region, and maybe the fact that there is rumors about Saudi-Turkish military action is maybe just an indication that people are trying to figure out new ways. But that is not the same thing as saying, okay, we're going to use military power, we're going to engage militarily, we're going to send troops. That's very, very different. The fact that the Turks and the Saudis can maybe work together, and in terms of supporting some of the some of those groups, yes. But when it comes to the point you made earlier about the United States and Turkey were wrong in predicting the early demise of Bashar al-Assad. It's an understandable mistake. I mean, you've had essentially three leaders fall one after the other in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. So it made sense at the time to assume that Assad would fall the same way. It is the same mistake people made about Saddam Hussein at the end of the first Gulf War when they thought that Saddam Hussein would be overthrown by the people because, after all, he had lost two wars in succession. Well, the Ba'ath regimes and these kinds of authoritarian regimes don't go away that quickly. I mean, Gaddafi's Libya went down very quickly, but that's because that was a much more brittle system, much more personalistic. So if you want to overthrow Assad, it's going to take a lot of work. Maybe the Saudis and the Turks are starting to figure out a new strategy, and one can only wish them luck, because the sooner Assad is overthrown, the sooner the region will return to some kind of normalcy. That said, it is also very dangerous that to have two large Sunni powers involve themselves, and that will exacerbate the sectarian conflict in the region, because, let's face it, if you're an Alawite in Syria, you have absolutely no confidence that the Saudis or the Turks will protect you if Assad were to go. So this is very serious. I mean, people really fear for their lives. It may be real, it may be imaginary, it doesn't matter. People at the moment really think that if the other side wins, I'm dead. So even the rumors that the Turks and the Saudis are getting together, I think is going to galvanize the, shall we say, the sectarian feelings in Syria even more. It's going to make them feel more paranoid. It is exactly what the regime keeps telling them, that the people are out to get them. And so people will circle the wagons even more as a result of this.
Well, curiously, the Pope in his Sunday Mass at St. Peter's in Rome, where he talked about the Armenian genocide as the first genocide of the 20th century, and castigated Turkey for denying this, and he used the analogy of it being an open wound. The Pope himself, of course, is very concerned about the fate of Christians and other minorities in Syria and Iraq. We've already seen what the self-declared Islamic State has done to the Yazidis and the Christians in Iraq and to some extent in Syria. So it's a bit odd that the Pope, you know, obviously the Turks cannot abide any criticism, or they can't even abide the very concept that there was such a thing as the Armenian massacre. So they can't be too happy with the Pope's remarks, and the Pope surely needs their help in trying to protect these Christian and other minorities.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting point. I mean, when you look at the Turkish press today, it poured scorn over the Pope's comments, of course, of yesterday. But at the same time, this is also an indication on the part of the Pope that he doesn't trust the so-called Sunni powers to essentially protect the Christians in the region, because it's not just the Islamic State, but there's a whole series of militias at the moment operating in the region, some of which are we know about, some of which we don't. We know very little about, and where they get their arms, how they get their manpower. All of these things are questionable, and there is a lot of suspicion, of course, that the Turks have allowed a lot of jihadists to cross their borders to either join the Islamic State, not necessarily knowingly, but also al-Nusra, which they did actually support. And al-Nusra is another fundamentalist organization. It's an offshoot of al-Qaeda. So the difference between al-Nusra and the Islamic State is one of degrees and not fundamentally, they're not different organizations. So there is a lot of concern about the fact that, you know, in the pursuit or to overthrow Assad, etc., that Turkey and maybe the Saudis have been too lenient in supporting extremist elements. And that's what the Pope was maybe trying to signal as well yesterday.
Well, I don't know whether you saw the interview that Charlie Rose did with Bashar al-Assad on 60 Minutes, but Assad appeared to me to be both very much under siege and also very delusional. But the one thing that he said that made sense to me was when Charlie Rose was asking about the various factions like al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and the Islamic State that his forces are at war with. He said, don't talk to me about all of these different terrorist groups. They're all Wahhabis. It's all Wahhabi. What do you, you know, just let's get real. This is all the Wahhabis, basically pointing at Saudi Arabia as the real issue here. How do you see that?
Look, I think to say that they're all Wahhabis is simplifying the issue. I mean, the fact of the matter is, yes, they're all fundamentalists, and yes, they may be close to Wahhabi ideology, but they have also mutated over the years. They have emerged as on their own. I think to just say, oh, this is all Saudi Arabia's doing, I think is too simplistic. Now, do the Saudis have had a role in the creation of some of these extreme fundamentalist movements? Absolutely. I mean, after all, let's not forget, Bin Laden was a Saudi citizen and initially got a lot of support in Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of Saudi money that has gone to supporting, not government money, but rich individuals who have supported such causes over the years. So yes, I mean the Saudis do have a share the blame. But let's face it, Bashar al-Assad's regime is a minority regime that is exceedingly repressive and has done unspeakable things to its population. So for Bashar Assad to say, oh, it's all Wahhabis, is denying the most obvious, which is his regime is a problem. And the fact that his regime has been unable to deal with demands that came from his population, demands that are mostly demands about jobs, demands about housing, demands about a lack of water in the countryside. I mean, all these things that exacerbated tensions in Syria were not dealt with by a regime that is so fixated on its very, very, very small core and has essentially squandered Syria's resources. I mean, yes, when you look at what happened in Syria, there's not one single cause. There's climate change. There's a drought. There's the fact that the agricultural system has collapsed. The fact that there was a war next door in Iraq for all these years. All of these contributed. But fundamentally, you had a regime that did not understand what was going on because it is an authoritarian, almost totalitarian regime that is based on the idolization of one person, the president, whether it was Bashar or his father. So, you know, Bashar Assad can say whatever he wants, but he is very much the problem. But unfortunately, today in Syria, you do have a constituency behind him who, even if they don't believe him, don't see any way out but to support him because they're so afraid of the al-Nusras and the ISIS or the Islamic State.
Well, so
we are in a really no-win situation. This is a disaster.
Well, Henri Bakke, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He serves as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. He has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with someone who has known Hillary Clinton since her days at Yale Law School. Acayipsin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Derek Shearer, a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the MacKinnon Center for Global Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Derek Shearer.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And not only are you at President Obama's alma mater, you're also a very, very old and close friend of Hillary Clinton's. You've known her since she first met your friend Bill Clinton at the Yale Law School. Can we talk a little bit about the person? I mean, I know she's on a road trip now, going through Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and on her way to Iowa. And, you know, we know that, for example, the Koch brothers have formed a fund of, I believe, $1 billion that they got pledges from a secret meeting they had recently down here in Newport Beach to defeat her. So we know what's arrayed against her. And as far as I know, and I think you can fill us in a little bit on this, I think that she's more of a product of a meritocracy, and that in effect she's up against a plutocracy. So is it possible that this 2016 presidential race will in fact be a challenge to whether the U.S. continues to have some vestiges of meritocracy or becomes a plutocracy?
Well, I think that's one way to look at it, Ian. It's not quite the way, you know, I look at it. I think it's absolutely true that Mrs. Clinton is someone who made herself into a formidable politician and world figure. I mean, she came from a kind of lower class home outside of Chicago. She worked very hard, did well in school, went to a very good school, Wellesley, and then to a very good law school. She didn't come from a privileged or upper class background. And, you know, she is somewhat similar to her husband, although Bill Clinton's upbringing was even a bit more hard scrabble. But they're both our products of people who worked hard, used education to get ahead, and they're both products of the 1960s and of all of those social and activist movements. And they were formed by them, and those are their values. And although we're all now, you know, of a bit advanced age, we carry that legacy and outlook with us. And I think what the election is really about is one party that stands for change and stands for a diverse, more equitable, decent America, and sadly another party that's kind of profoundly reactionary, that's very upset about all of the progressive changes that took place in the 60s and 70s and even up to today with things like gay marriage, and who really want to preserve a mythical America of the 1950s, you know, when minorities knew their place, women stayed home, there were no gays, it was just a tragic illness, and somehow, you know, this was the great America. It's a very backward-looking party, and the others are very forward-looking, and so I think, you know, these moneyed brothers, the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson, I mean, they're part and parcel of this effort to stop change from proceeding.
But that's not to say that there are some on the political left. In fact, in the conversation yesterday, somebody was saying to me, oh, she comes from a wealthy Chicago suburb and went to Wellesley and Yale Law School. My understanding is that she actually, her first job was gutting fish at a fish factory in Alaska. Now, it's true that Bill Clinton, through his foundation, has raised a lot of money from a lot of wealthy people. So I don't know whether that's going to rub off on her, but do you see this as being, you know, again, I know you don't agree that it's as simple as a meritocracy versus a plutocracy, but if this very right-wing Republican Party, now dominated by the Tea Party, ends up controlling, they already control the Supreme Court if they and the Senate and the House, and if they get the presidency, I think it's not unreasonable to be a little afraid that we will be certainly become more of a plutocracy.
Well, I think a lot is at stake. And there was a very good column by Paul Krugman today in the New York Times saying, he's the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he said, if you look at the two parties, I mean, the differences are incredibly profound, not only from who backs them in terms of money, but what they stand for, and that the outcome is going to make a tremendous difference to the country. It will make a big difference, and because the forces, as you've outlined them, are going to be so well-funded, it's really going to take somebody who's tough enough to withstand the rigors of a national campaign and all the kinds of attacks at every level that are going to be coming at her, because she knows that what's at stake is really important to the country.
But we know from the last election that the Democrats didn't show up. It was only 37% of the eligible voters in this country showed up, and almost every Republican did show up. And there is an asymmetry. When Republicans get mad, they vote. When Democrats get mad, they stay home.
Well, yeah, it's an off-year election, and more people will turn out in presidential elections. And if you go back and, of course, look at the two elections of President Barack Obama, those were elections in which the Democratic base was mobilized to turn out because they viewed the election as something that could really affect their lives. And I don't think there's any doubt that the effort to mobilize voters will take place from the Democratic Party in the coming election, and that I think there will be, a very strong, healthy turnout. I mean, in America, we make it hard for people to vote. I mean, in Australia, as you know, voting's required. You get a parking ticket if you don't vote. And many other countries register people to vote automatically as part of their citizenship. We don't do that. You have to register yourselves. And in a lot of states, for lots of reasons, race being one, we've tried to prevent people from registering and voting. So, I don't kind of blame the American people if they don't all vote in off-year elections. But I think in presidential year, they're going to turn out. And I think the key to victory, of course, is for the coalition that elected Obama twice to be built, strengthened, and expanded for Mrs. Clinton.
And again, I'm speaking with Derek Shearer, a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the McKinnon Center for Global Affairs. So if this is a case of the cycles where in general elections, more people and particularly more Democrats show up, nevertheless, Hillary Clinton has to somehow get the young. I don't think she'll have a problem getting the women out. But the young and what you could loosely call the Democratic left, who are already enamored with Elizabeth Warren. Now, Elizabeth Warren, I don't know whether you read the New York Review of Books profile on her, has a really interesting life story. But so too, as far as I know, does Hillary Clinton. And I think if that story gets out about the fact that she does come from working in middle-class roots and has worked her way up and is a product of a meritocracy, that could make a difference. So,
well, I agree with you, Ian. I'm one of these people who thinks it's important for candidates and campaigns to, tell their story and control their narrative. And I would be very surprised if that kind of narrative and those kind of facts are not in major biopic videos that the campaign produces and in narrative and stories that Mrs. Clinton tells. I was with her this past fall when she gave a major lecture at UCLA, and what I found particularly interesting was that it wasn't a policy wonk speech. It was a narrative about her life, and she didn't mention the Alaska, gutting of fish, but she talked about how she had registered Latino voters for McGovern in Texas. She talked about her work with the Legal Services Corporation. She talked about her first big involvement in national issues, which was with the Children's Defense Fund, and her mentor, Marion Wright Edelman. And so she used elements of her life story to illustrate issues and what she really cared about. And she was very effective, I think, and it's certainly by the audience, which had a lot of young students in it who didn't know that much about her, and it really resonated. But that's going to be part of the job of the campaign, to tell that story and not let it get, you know, overridden by all the media craziness that goes on in a campaign.
Well, but already she's being criticized for the issuing a video, a well-produced video announcing her presidency, as opposed to doing it in person.
Ian, everything she's going to do is going to be criticized by someone. I mean, you know, this is the era we live in, and, you know, the press likes to criticize the Clintons, and, you know, even the New York Times, that is supposedly usually objective, I mean, I still think it's the greatest paper in the world, but some of their reporting, you know, kind of steps into almost advocacy. I mean, the latest piece about her announcement said she has to prove da-da-da. You know, it's not even quoting anybody. It's sort of the author's voice. You know, I think a lot of that goes away because I just kind of informally asked some people today about the video, and they liked it. I mean, you know, they thought it was the right approach to not put her front and center, but to show the people she's going to care about and work for, and thought it was very effective. Now, somebody else might not like it, but I would argue that if you do something like that and 3/4 of the people like it and 25% think it's terrible, that's fine.
Well, we know that she's up against a big field of Republicans, and Marco Rubio just entered the fray today, and Ted Cruz already has, and so has Rand Paul. And Rand Paul was just on television yesterday saying that Hillary Clinton's foreign policy was as hawkish as John McCain's, who he was also criticizing. And he was basically saying, you know, don't vote for her because she's as hawkish as the Republicans that I oppose and who oppose him. And, you know, he is doing pretty well with a lot of disenchanted young people because they think it's because he champions smoking pot, they forget about his domestic issues and that he's in favor of smoking pot and against foreign entanglements seems to overshadow or be sufficient for them to overlook his domestic politics. So how is she going to get around his criticism, Rand Paul's?
If Rand Paul is the nominee, I would predict that it will be another Goldwater-Johnson race. If there is a real Tea Party-ish, and he is one, even though he's got, because Tea Party has no foreign policy, so he's created it for them, candidate, it could be a massive Democratic victory. And I think that's the fear of the Republican Party elite. That's why so many of them are, you know, running to get behind what they see as a somewhat more mainstream candidate like Jeb Bush. But I think those candidates that sound amusing, but their views, when you really start to look at what they say, what they stand for, where they're from, are way out of the mainstream. And I won't even, I mean, you can read the reporting in on how Rand Paul deals with the media. Not real subtle. You know, he's already had this kind of weird response to women reporters. I mean, boy, I'd love for him to be the nominee.
Right. Well, I don't think the Democrats are necessarily going to be that lucky to either get a Ted Cruz or a Rand Paul. But nevertheless, there are a lot of Democrats who find John McCain and Lindsey Graham scary. And
But because Rand Paul's not a very reliable source, I mean, I'm sure McCain's upset. He doesn't like Rand Paul anyway, but for Rand Paul to say she's as hawkish as John McCain, as I say, is just nonsense. She was our top diplomat as Secretary of State, and assuming she is the nominee and becomes president, she's going to be following through and making sure that the diplomatic initiatives that Obama has undertaken in his last 2 years actually come to fruition. I mean, that's one of the really important things about this election when it comes to foreign policy is that two of, I think, the most important things Obama's done, the opening to Cuba and the negotiations with Iran, they're not going to be done and all over and you forget about them with the next president. It's just like when Nixon went to China and started that opening, it took actually, people forget, Jimmy Carter's presidency to actually normalize relations and send an ambassador. So, you know, in foreign policy, a lot's at stake as well as in domestic policy.
But in terms of the debates, and there's no question that the Republicans in the last round with Mitt Romney and that huge field on those big stages did get a lot of airtime. And it's a great venue for people to learn about their candidates. And if you only have one candidate, or at this point, you know, you've got Governor O'Malley and Jim Webb. But it feels to me like there's got to be, just for the sake of a dialogue instead of a monologue, there's got to be more people out there. How would you get somebody like a Bernie Sanders on that stage? Is that possible?
Well, Bernie would have to run if he wanted to do it. But, I mean, is Bernie a Democrat now? I thought he was an independent socialist.
Well, he's trying to figure out how to get on the debate. So,
Bernie's a nice guy. I've known him a long time from when he was mayor and stuff. But is he a serious presidential candidate? You know, I don't think so. I don't think primary debates necessarily are going to be the big determinant of this election. And I'm not one who says I wish there was a big challenger so the Democrats could spend lots of money fighting amongst themselves, as you already pointed out, because of the Supreme Court decision on contributions and the incredible amount of money that very conservative individuals and groups have aligned against any Democrat, and certainly they will against Mrs. Clinton. It's much better if the Democrats don't spend a lot of money in the primary, and there will be some people who run against her, and they will have an opportunity. Government O'Malley can try it out if Bernie wants to, you know, who'll challenge her in debates. But I don't think we need to have someone who's going to, like, let's wish for somebody to damage her in some way. There's not a lot of secrets about the Clintons that we don't know. People have a pretty good sense of her, and as you said, she just has to tell her own history and backstory better. But I'm quite happy with a quiet primary myself.
Well, but the process is a kind of crucible, and it does sharpen them up. I just in closing, Derek Shearer, I sure hope she gets a better campaign manager than the last one.
I think you, I guarantee you, the one thing I can tell your listeners, Ian, is that there is a grown-up in charge, John Podesta, who is the chairman of the campaign. And they've hired some very talented young people who have to do all the hard, you know, day-to-day work and the ground work that goes on in all the states. But John is as smart as a progressive, you know, as you're going to find in this country, who understands politics and how to win, but has good values. So I'm pretty, pleased that he's agreed to do this and be the chair.
Well, Derek Shearer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Derek Shearer, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Finland. He's currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the MacKinnon Center for Global Affairs. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the Pope's condemnation of Turkey's denial of the Armenian genocide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ronald Sunni, a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He is the author of the new book, Just Out, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald Sunni.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And the Pope on Sunday at the St. Peter's Basilica in Rome talked about the Armenian Genocide as the first genocide of the 20th century. He went on to say the remaining two were perpetuated by Nazism and Stalinism, and more recently there have been other mass killings like those in Cambodia, Rwanda, Burundi, and Bosnia. And already Turkey has recalled their ambassador to the Vatican and expressed outrage at the Pope's remarks. Why is it that the Turks are so boneheaded and obdurate in their denial of the genocide, and they continue to do so? And I don't understand it in the face of overwhelming historical reality.
For a long time, Ian, I could not figure that out myself. I've got several answers that came to mind. The way Turks and the government itself has tended to identify itself as a modernizing, a revolutionary regime which was going to bring civilization to Turkey. But more recently, a couple of things have come to mind. One is the foundation of this Turkish Republic, of what you might call the Kemalist Republic, in fact was based on two kinds of elimination. One was the Armenian Genocide, the ethnic cleansing, the removal of the Armenian people from that part of the world, and the forced assimilation of Armenians into the population of Muslims. Then the expulsion of the Greeks sometime later and the population exchanges that took place in the early 1920s. So instead of the mythology which characterizes the foundation of the Turkish Republic, that is the liberation struggle of the Kemalists against the Allies, against Greeks, against Armenians, the so-called Kurtuluş Savaşı in Turkish, liberation war, you have these terrible crimes that homogenize the territory of today's Turkey and made it possible for a Turkish Islamic Republic to emerge. Now, that's hard to do. To change the foundation, the founding myths of a country, and show that in fact disastrous and terrible crimes, in fact, were the basis of this new country.
But they could have gotten themselves off the hook by blaming it all on the Young Turks, who, after all, were in charge when it happened, and the Kemalists under Atatürk came in later. So why did they not pin it on them, and they wouldn't be stuck with this stain on history?
That would have been one possible tactic to try, but the facts are that the Young Turks, in some ways, were the predecessors of the Kemalists. Many Young Turks later found their ways into the Kemalist movement. Kemal himself had been a member of the Young Turk movement, though he was not involved in the genocide. So there is a continuity and less of a break. Now, Kemal also got rid of some of the Young Turks who threatened his own power, but there is that link, and that link with Turkish nationalism, both before and after the end of the Ottoman Empire. So there's more continuity than change that went on, and my sense is that the foundational myth, which could have sort of made that difference greater, was fudged up a little bit so that the harsh realities of where the new Turkey emerged, from where it emerged, were hidden and now are part of that denialist campaign.
Well, the Pope, in framing his remarks, was talking about exactly what we're talking about, which is why cover up history. And he said that, "For whenever memory fades, it means that evil allows wounds to fester. Concealing or denying evil is like allowing a wound to keep bleeding without bandaging it." Now, we're within a week of the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. You would have thought that with the world's attention, I mean, first of all, what Turkey has tried to do ahead of the 100th anniversary is change the date of the Gallipoli Memorial, which is April the 25th, which is always celebrated, and particularly on the 100th anniversary, there'll be lots of Australians and New Zealanders, etc., showing up. Their embassies around the world invited everybody to come a day earlier on the 24th to commemorate Gallipoli to try and deflect attention away from the Armenian genocide. So it's like they're still desperately trying to deny something or what the Pope would call, an open wound.
First of all, I would say that these moves are kind of small-time and short-sighted political moves. As President Erdogan and his government, which has actually allowed freer discussion, more open discussion of the events of 1915, is about to face an election. And in that particular moment, it wants to present a good, solid nationalist front to the electorate. And it doesn't want to be outflanked by people to the right of it, the Kemalists, the nationalists, the chauvinists, and even fascists, because there's lots of those kinds of people around, who would raise this issue. In the popular imagination of many Turks, the worst thing is to be labeled an Armenian. And even Erdogan has complained when he's been attacked and saying, you know what, you call me an Armenian or you think I'm like an Armenian. So in that particular setting, any concession at this point to the pressure that's being mounted from outside and from Armenians both inside and outside Turkey would seem like weakness, like giving in to these foreign and alien forces. And so that sort of stiffens their back, stiffens their resolve, and makes it even more impossible for them to come to terms with this tragedy.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronald Suni, who's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of a new book just out, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. Now, I don't know whether you know David Phillips at Columbia, but he headed up an effort to bring about truth and reconciliation, a diplomatic effort to bring Turkey and Armenia together. And they made some progress, but at the last minute, the Turks balked. But there have been efforts along these lines, and there was a protocol arrived at in these talks. Do you think that this will ever go away, that... You know, as I said, one would have thought that this occasion on the 100th anniversary might have been the time for the Turks to sort of get this sort of festering wound dealt with.
There were a lot of efforts over the years. The David Phillips thing, track two diplomacy of all kinds. We had our own scholarly efforts where we brought Turks and Armenians together in something called WATS, the Workshop on Armenian-Turkish Scholarship. We made a lot of progress. We published a couple of books on that. There is dialogue. There's a progressive Turkish intelligentsia now in Turkey that, and Kurds as well, who recognize the genocide, who write about it, who appear publicly. The Kurdish population has, in fact, apologized for the genocide in which they participated. And there's movement among younger scholars, Armenian scholars in Armenia and in the diaspora. So there's been a lot of progress. But ultimately, the Turkish government itself has balked at these kinds of changes and just simply seems unwilling to make the kind of move that, say, the Germans made after the war. And, you know, it's not a mystery exactly. That is, it's hard for countries to face up to some of the things they've done in the past or to question the myths about their own foundation. Think about our own country and the way we've covered up for so many years the ethnic cleansing and even some would say genocide of the American Indians, or the foundation of Israel and the expulsion of 700,000 to 800,000 Palestinians, or the way the Japanese refused to acknowledge what they did in China at Nanking, or to the Korean comfort women. This seems to me a general thing, and the only way I can be hopeful about change in the future is to think that let's keep pushing, let's keep writing, let's keep thinking about what really happened, and as the Pope put it, and you so eloquently quoted this, what the consequences of burying the truth are, what the consequences of this denial is, that the wounds keep festering, that healing doesn't take place, reconciliation becomes impossible.
So, Ronald Sunni, what do you think will happen on the 24th of April then?
Well, there are thousands of people going to Turkey, Armenians and others. There'll be quiet demonstrations. There'll be commemorations. There'll be markings of all kinds. There are people going to march in the hundreds of thousands, probably in Yerevan as well, to Tisarnak Abert, the monument to the genocide. There'll be concerts in New York. There'll be all kinds of recognitions and commemorations. There are scholarly conferences. I've been at one this weekend at UCLA. There's one coming up at Berkeley. There's been one in Michigan as well. We've done a lot of that. It seems to me all of those things are positive, and maybe the noise is a little loud right now for the Turks to appear as if they're about to give up or surrender on this issue. But maybe the ground is being laid for some future time, a quieter moment, when the Turks might, in fact, gradually move away from the denial. They might not accept the term genocide. That's a controversial and difficult word. It has international law connotations. But they might be willing to accept that, yes, there was a deliberate, intentional mass deportation, dispersion, massacre, and assimilation of hundreds of thousands, perhaps over a million, Armenians and Assyrians in 1915 and 1916.
So why do you think the Pope took this stand? I mean, his previous predecessors had mentioned it, but not the extent to which he has really laid it on the line. And many people are wondering why he did it, given that the Vatican is very concerned about the fate of Iraqi Christians and Syrian Christians who are at the mercy of the self-declared Islamic State. And Turkey, you know, they need Turkey's help to get these people out of these countries into a safe haven in Turkey.
This Pope is really unique. I mean, it's a funny thing to say about a clerical figure, but he's kind of iconoclastic. That is, he breaks with older conventions and with, in a way, sacred cows. He turns the eye of the church toward the poor, the dispossessed, the migrants, etc. He's been amazing as a moral figure. Now, various world leaders, leaders of the United States, including Barack Obama and other great powers, have made expedient strategic choices, pragmatic choices. Oh, we can't insult the Turks. They're our allies. We need them in NATO. We need them in the struggle against ISIS or in Afghanistan, or formerly against the Soviet Union. So there's always a reason to trim your moral conscience and make these kind of strategic, pragmatic choices instead. The Pope didn't do that. He put morality and the long-term consequences of denial and distortion of history above short-term strategic decisions. And this, I think, is not only morally correct, but in some ways pragmatically sensible. If the United States and President Obama continue to not deny that this was a genocide and not use the G word, then what they're doing objectively is siding with the worst elements in Turkish society. That is the deniers, the nationalists, the chauvinists, the anti-European types, the ones who want to turn their back on their minorities within the country. If you recognize the genocide, then you would be siding with what I've called the progressive Turkish intelligentsia, with the Kurdish people in their struggle against repression by the Turkish government, with those who are looking toward Europe, to greater democracy, to the critics of Erdogan's authoritarian tendencies within the country. So you have to take a stand. You have to decide which side you're on. And you might have short-term consequences, short-term losses, but in the long run, by doing the right thing, it seems to me, you'll reap other and greater benefits.
Well, apparently, Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat in Southern California who represents a largely Armenian district, he is the lead sponsor of a proposed Armenian Genocide Truth and Justice resolution in the House. But my sense is that the military, intelligence, diplomatic establishment just has a pretty fixed position with Turkey being a NATO member, even though, by the way, Turkey is not allowing the U.S. and its coalition to use the Incirlik Air Force Base, which would make the bombing of the self-declared Islamic State a lot easier than having to launch aircraft carriers in the Gulf. And that remains a bit of a puzzlement. So for all of the bending over backwards not to offend Turkey, it doesn't look like the U.S. is getting a lot out of its relationship at the moment.
I couldn't agree more. I think once you show that kind of weakness, you know, once you show that, oh, we're willing to look the other way because we need you, then of course, you know, you can be manipulated. I don't want to make this a complete analogy, but during World War One, while the genocide was actually taking place, Turkey was an ally in that war with the German Empire. And the Germans knew what was going on. Consuls and missionaries, photographers were watching the Armenians being slaughtered. They reported back to their government. The government, the Kaiser himself, the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, told the Germans in Turkey, their ambassador, don't interfere. The Turks are allies. They're necessary to win this war. Look the other way. And they didn't, in fact, do anything. And they became complicit in the genocide itself. In some ways, we're complicit in the denial of the truth and the ongoing festering of this wound that the Pope talked about so eloquently yesterday.
Well, Ronald Sunni, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ronald Sunni, who's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He is the author of the new book, Just Out, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.